Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis with PodcastUFO.com. Today's episode is our second session with Don Schmidt on Roswell. How you doing, Don?
Yeah, it's great to be with you again, Martin. So it's been too long, but it's all my fault, and I accept responsibility. But those of us who are tend to be a little bit more obsessed with our research, we tend to disappear in the woodwork at times because we like to become flies on the walls of certain witnesses and the like, and we have to hide our actions at times. But nothing nefarious, but nonetheless, we're the proactive investigators who are out in the trenches still trying to solve, you know, this ultimate mystery, which we believe is the biggest story of the millennium.
Yes. I appreciate the time that actually has gone by because the more things have happened, so there's more to talk about.
There always is, and that's the amazing thing. Even Larry King a number of times mentioned to us that, for a story that is now over 50, as it turns out now, 65 years old, it comes back stronger every year, no matter how the debunkers, no matter how often the government tries to explain it away, it still keeps rising to the surface. And myths don't do that. Hoaxes don't do that. Once they're, explained away, that typically is the end of it. But it's the truth that keeps bubbling to the top. And that's why I'm so confident that we're dealing here with a legitimate situation, because it keeps trying to come out as it truly happened. The witnesses, even to their deathbeds, continue to come forward, not by us insisting that they do so, but their families so often seek us out. We need to tell you about what my husband just said, what my father just said, that type of thing. And it's the same story over and over again, that indeed we recovered a flying saucer back in 1947.
In the last podcast we did together, a real quick recap, you explained the situation and also about the witnesses, and the number of witnesses was somewhere around 600, direct or indirect.
Yes.
And out of those 600, the thing that really struck in that podcast with me is out of those 600 witnesses, that not one single witness said that it could have been a weather balloon or crash dummies or the mogul.
That's true. That remains true.
So
after all these years, yes.
Yeah, that right there, that says a little bit right there.
Oh, it certainly does.
Yeah.
I just imagine if I was a government defense attorney, defense in the sense that, say we would actually take a legal step, we would have a class action suit representing all the civilians who were involved, who directly were threatened by officials, by military officers within our own United States government to essentially keep their mouths shut about what they knew to be the truth. And under the, penalties of death, I mean, as we described in the previous program, how parents were told, we will kill your children if you ever discuss this again, if you ever talk about this in public. Well, what could be so sensitive involving civilians that in strict violation of the United States Constitution, the United States government would use its own military to threaten its own citizenry? And so we would take a class action suit, just as a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to defend their actions. Well, first of all, they have to explain why they came up with the counter solution, the counter explanation being that it was a common weather balloon device with a radar reflector kite, if again it was something else. And then some 50 years later, they would come up with another theory, as it turned out, Project Mogul, which was a similar balloon device, but it was a top-secret project back in 1947, in that it was determining whether the Soviets were detonating their own atomic devices post-World War II. And the concept was that we would pick up a shockwave in the upper atmosphere. Okay, fine. The project was top-secret, but certainly the components were not. It was still a balloon.
Hmm.
And the last one being the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummies. So they'd have to defend all of these silly counter, ploys to essentially suppress this, bury this, cover this up. And then they first would have to demonstrate and prove why it necessitated, you know, the need to threaten American citizens. Again, if it wasn't something so ultra-secret, so sensitive, so unbelievable that they had to resort to even death threats. So I would love to see this, you know, play out in a court of law. We've been approached by a number of TV networks in the past, you know, if we'd even be interested in such a scenario, actually taking Roswell to court. In fact, after our next book, which is on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the next book on Roswell will be essentially Roswell's Day in Court. The tentative title is Roswell, the Final Verdict. And we will present it as we would, given such an opportunity, how this would play out and how these over 600 witnesses directly or indirectly involved, sadly most of them now deceased, but nonetheless that they're testimony is on the public record. They have signed affidavits. They have given video depositions. They have told us in non-contradictory terms that this indeed did happen, that this was something not manufactured here, this was something not made on this earth, that as the one officer said, they sure weren't from Texas in reference to the bodies, and on and on and on. And as you mentioned, Martin, there are no witnesses that refute that. The skeptics constantly, you know, dredge up not even any way, in any way, as far as witnesses, to support what they can only present as personal attacks, attacks on the witnesses, attacks on us. And to me, that's a losing hand. Because the wealth of circumstantial and evidentiary, you know, information regarding this incident is just beyond the human pale. The idea that over 600 people would be telling us the same story. A police officer should be so lucky in investigating any crime, and you'd have a dozen witnesses, and if they would all tell you the same account.
Right.
People's observational capacities just aren't, you know, that in tune with even their immediate environment at any one given time. So this, too, smacks of just how profound, how unique this was. It has stood the test of time. It remains indelibly etched in their subconsciouses, and whenever they're asked about it, as one of the witnesses described, it's the first thing I think about in the morning, and it's the last thing I think about at night.
Wow. Wow. Now, you mentioned just a few minutes ago about the death threats. Have you spoken to more than one person that has said the same thing on that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, one of the more recent accounts involved the wife of Peter Anaya, who worked out at the base at that time and was involved in retrieving, picking up the Lieutenant Governor, Joseph Montoya, at that time with his brother, Reuben, and another individual who also worked out at the base. And his wife would describe that a number of military officers arrived at their home that evening and insisted that her husband come outside, but she could still overhear all the yelling, the conversation as it took place, as it went down. And basically they're telling her to stay in the house, stay out of it, but insisting that her husband never say a word about what happened, and that if they ever did, they would be killed.
Wow. Wow.
And she wasn't even directly involved, and so they used her as leverage. They used her to really, as far as emphasize the fact that this is something, again, that can never come out. Again, it speaks quite profoundly of just how important this was and the extreme levels to which they had to resort to make sure that people didn't talk about it.
So back several months ago, we were going to record at 7 p.m., I believe, your time, and you were hot on the trail of something to do with Roswell, and we couldn't hook up. Can you talk about what that was at the time?
I can go into it briefly because it's something we're still working on. In fact, we're working on it every day because it could involve physical evidence.
Oh.
And as a result, it involved a quick, unscheduled trip and actually meeting with someone who is in possession of said material. And we're talking specifically regarding the remains, something, you know, pertain to the bodies.
Oh.
So this is beyond material or even physical material from the craft, the ship, the crash site, that type of thing. So it's something new. It's something we've had a number of false alarms regarding in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular situation is much more promising.
Wow, biological, more or less.
Yes.
Wow.
I won't put it that way either because I don't want to. I'm being very careful.
Yes.
Because again, people's lives may be at risk, and I have to be careful not to certainly telegraph our actions.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say it will either go down as a tremendous hoax that people went through a tremendous effort and expense to try to perpetrate this. And if not, it potentially is a smoking gun.
Wow.
And
could
so
finally put
stay
this,
tuned.
I could finally put this thing to bed, basically, which would be nice.
I would like to think so, but given the skeptical mindset of especially the American press, the American media, that enough will never be enough.
Hmm.
It comes down to when will it be enough for us that we can walk away and just go mission accomplished and feel justified in our essentially shutting down the effort. I'd like to believe it's sometime in the near future. I'd like to believe that it could happen as soon as tomorrow, if our efforts, you know, continue to produce results. But nonetheless, I have to resign myself to accept that enough may never be enough. That it is still something that, again, we have to keep in mind that the powers that be, starting at the time of the incident, 1947, decided that this was never to come out. And I don't mean that it was going to be just a 5-year, you know, lag time, or 10 years, or even 50 years. It's quite evident that the way they have buried this, the manner by which as many people have died with this, and not passing it down, as I've often said, the old order in the military is not passing it down to the new. So it's not like there's even a continuing project, a continuing effort to solve this. It's like they've always had the answer, but yet they don't have any answers, that being the cover of ignorance. They have the physical proof, but they don't have any motives. They don't know from where, from why, or from who. And they still can't plug it in. They still can't make it work, so to speak, as far as reverse engineering or developing any technology as a result of this recovery back in 1947. So I would think out of even frustration, lack of any return on their part for all of their efforts in these past 65 years, that they just have washed their hands of it. And it's like the phenomenon exists, it's there, and there's nothing we can do about it. And how do they go to the public? How do they, you know, announce to the world that we've been visited, we are being visited, that aircraft are flying through our airspace with total impunity for all these years, and we can't do anything about it? Well, I mean, what elected official is going to make that announcement?
Right. And if it was, it would have to be, for all the skeptics to actually believe it, it would probably have to be the President of the United States live on TV announcing it, or maybe not even then.
Not even then, because let's cite the most recent example as far as with the assassination of Osama bin Laden. And there it was, a case of the president, President Obama, going before the American people and making that very announcement and even going into some detail on how it was accomplished and the steps that led up to their finally discovering his whereabouts and then and how he was killed. And nonetheless, within days after, there were version after version after version.
Yeah, conspiracy.
And it was like I was doing a talk in Illinois shortly thereafter, and I jokingly even made the statement, made the announcement that a major terrorist, the man behind 9/11, who had instrumented as far as that fatal attack, as far as on our own shores, had finally been killed by American troops. And then I posed the question, now which version are we asked to believe? Which one are we going to believe? Was it Navy SEALs? Was it Air Force Delta Force? Was it Army Special Forces in conjunction with one another? Or how many troops were involved? Was there an actual gunfight that took place? And on and on and on. And demonstrating that, again, even if the president makes such a statement, such an announcement, it still comes down to the cynic in so many of us. It's sad that it's become the case with the press, with elected officials. We look every time there is a popularity poll taken as far as job performance and even profession, we always see that politicians rate right at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And yet the military rates still very highly. Now, the military rates highly and justifiably. You know, they are certainly, you know, on the front lines. They are preserving our freedoms, our liberties. They're, you know, taking all of the risk right now while we sit very calm, very, very snugly in our homes every night. And they so often don't even know if they're going to see tomorrow.
Right.
They deserve all of the accolades, all of the credit they so rightly deserve. But who instructs them? Who directs them? It's the very politicians who are at the other end of the rung, other end of the ladder. So it's so often that the military has to sell its soul to the devil, so to speak. Hmm. And so we get back to 1947. The fact that the military, just coming off of World War II, we were at probably our highest patriotic, you know, level in our country's history. The military walked on water at that time.
Yeah.
And yet, it was the politicians in Washington, in conjunction with the Pentagon and the commander-in-chief, who I'm sure issued the instructions, and that being President Harry Truman at that time, you do what you have to. And that's what always provides a president or any politician plausible deniability. But you instruct your subordinates, your people in the field. You do what you have to. And I don't have to know about it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they didn't go to the Army manual because what chapter, you know, what reference do they have? Now, how do we deal with the recovery of a crashed flying saucer? it just wasn't there. This was totally unprecedented. Mm-hmm. Skeptics would like to water down, you know, this position that back in 1947, you know, I've even heard the remark that, well, some of the people involved were UFO buffs. Well, first of all, the term UFO was not even germane at that time. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't even be developed for four more years. And specifically by Captain Edward Ruppelt, who was first director of Project Blue Book. But the notion that there was anything, any books, anything on TV or in the movies at that time, the common depiction of alien spacecraft by Hollywood back at that time were rockets.
Right.
And if we go back to Buck Rogers and mm-hmm. Flash Gordon, you know, even aliens were just human beings just wearing costumes.
Right.
So we have to do our homework. We have to be accurate. And that's why, even with the best evidence, I think it still comes down to if we are confident that it satisfies our last concerns, half the people are going to believe us and half it will never matter. And again, if I feel I've done due diligence, my partner Tom Carey and I, the rest of our team, that we have provided the final solution beyond any doubt, it will be mission accomplished. It won't matter what the press, it won't matter what the politicians say. We will know that we have proven it to ourselves. And I guess after all is said and done, it all comes down to what do we hold to be the truth? What do we truly believe as being factual? It doesn't matter what the next person believes.
We have some listener questions I'm going to read to you in a few minutes. But the last time we spoke on our last podcast, you talked about you were going to do a little more research into Frank Kaufman. And I wondered,
yes,
have you done any of that since we last spoke?
To be honest with you, Martin, no. Granted, I mean, a lot of questions still remaining, but because Mr. Kaufman has already passed away, and even though he was our star witness in our second book in 1994, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, that I co-authored with Dr. Kevin Randall. And since that time, Kaufman, we were the ones responsible for exposing him as being totally fraudulent, that even the documents, his background, everything that he presented to us was not true. He was not a witness to the Roswell event as he described. He may have had some cursory involvement, but to the point of your question, because he's already passed away, he's in our grave basket at the moment, because there's a greater urgency to still deal with the people still with us, find them, give them an opportunity to go on the record. So, but yes, it's something down the road that will definitely be looked into. We strongly suspected Mr. Kaufman had marching orders. He was minding the store, so to speak, living in Roswell, and he latched on to us as quickly as he did, and he didn't let go. If he didn't hear from us in a week or two, he would actually call me up. And, well, who else, what new witnesses have you talked to, Don? What's new? Like he was reporting to someone.
Right.
But for another program.
Yeah. You mentioned a few minutes ago that your team of people, so it's you, Kevin, and Kevin, do you have other people working with you?
Kevin Randall. Dr. David Rudiak, who's a professor of optometry, who specializes in photo interpretation, Anthony Bagalia, Chris Wachowski up in Canada, and Professor Frank Kimmler, who we'll be talking about in the balance of the program. And there's even an attorney who works with us, named Christopher Carson. And with him, we're submitting more and more Freedom of Information Act requests. So we're hitting them from all directions because we realize it's the fourth quarter. And we have the ball as far as we're concerned. And we're going in for the score. So we're going to make this our best effort yet. And so we've assembled what has even been referenced to as the Roswell Dream Team. Not by myself. I have not called it that, but that's what it's being called, the Roswell Dream Team. So it will be part of this next book also on Roswell, the Roswell Verdict, that we will assemble all of our information, all of our evidence, and present it as we would in a court of law.
I would like to see that made into a movie. That sounds like such a great idea.
Well, it would be part of the Magic Men.
Oh, well, okay.
Motion picture. And then we are also working as far as with another production company who has approached us about actually doing a series on Roswell on cable TV. And because even in our current book, Witness to Roswell, that if one could imagine each of those chapters being another episode, that type of thing. And we wrote the book as far as with the very intent of, with the very objective, as far as presenting it in such a way that each chapter would stand on its own. And we never thought that. My God, yeah, we're writing TV episodes here. We're writing episodes that could easily be made into an hour program. Mm-hmm. And that's what the producer recognized. And so there's also that possibility.
Great. Now, I'm going to talk to you quickly about two controversial people, I would say. One of them is I interviewed a while back, Stan Romanek. And Stan, during the interview, said that he had images of the Roswell crash. And I said something along the lines, well, wouldn't that be like the greatest news in history to come out? And he just kind of brushed it off. So I'm sure nothing's happened with that. Or have you heard anything about that?
No, and the thing is, I know Stan. In fact, last fall when I lectured twice in Arizona, where he would have had two opportunities to even confront me, approach me mm-hmm. with such information. You know, Martin, always comes down to this. When somebody outside of our group, outside of the very outspoken, very, very available, very open, very approachable Roswell investigators who are leaving no stones unturned, who are open to every new lead, no matter how small. As I often say, especially in public appearances, let us decide if it's just a little trivial spark of information, mm-hmm. because it all, you know, they're all pieces to this puzzle that, you know, allow us to determine just how important something is. And I think witnesses so often are very surprised that a lead leads to something much bigger. And here's the case with Stan claiming that he actually has photographic evidence, and he's sitting on it. Stan, you have my phone number. You have my email. Give me a call.
Okay, and the next one I want to talk about is currently in the news right now. I've read a little bit about it. And at first glance, it looks real exciting until you dig into it a little more. Chase Brandon, a 35-year CIA veteran, claims that he saw a box full of Roswell evidence. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, we're not talking about just a happenstance, serendipitous, one-time opportunity to see something. We're talking about somebody who actually worked at CIA headquarters, and that is, you know, true. It's like based on his testimony that he would have had ample opportunity to photograph, secure, you know, some paper trail from his perspective, that he would have been able to provide us with something beyond just his eyewitness account of what he saw. And nonetheless, it isn't a case of where someone comes forward as a whistleblower and actually speaks to someone high up. Why didn't he pursue the issue? Why didn't he go to his superiors and ask them, well, what about this? You know, what is the truth about this? And I don't think he would have been violating as far as any regulations by just, he was just filing, you know, doing his daily assignments. And he happens to just stumble upon this box marked Roswell, and it has physical evidence and photographic evidence inside and all these documents. And it never crossed his mind that he had, you know, found the golden goose, laid the golden egg, and he didn't, you know, think that it was worth, you know, even going to Leavenworth for 10 years if he should break this wide open. The name, first of all, doesn't smack true. And as it turns out, we learn that Chase Brandon is actually a character. It's the name of a CIA operative in a series of books penned by, I think it's Sherry Bigby and Steve Hickok. And I think their latest book is something like Lake of Spies. And Chase Brandon is one of the CIA operatives in this novel.
Oh, my God.
So first of all, Chase Brandon clearly appears to be a pen name. The fact that it's similar to the Annie Jacobson book on Area 51, where they come up with this, they look for the hook. They look for something that's going to really draw attention. Well, we're talking about it right now, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's got everybody talking about it.
Yeah.
And all you have to do, and they constantly use Roswell for that hook. And to me, it's more gratifying in that it happens to be Roswell, that they realize that even the Air Force's recent explanations, if someone comes out with something else, the press is right there to at least try to exploit it, make it into a big news story. And I'm certainly of the position that that's exactly what at least his publisher is doing as far as with his new book. Hmm. And is it interesting that Mr. Brandon, whatever his real name is,
is out
hawking a book right now.
Uh-huh. That's right. That's right. All right, I'm going to read some questions that listeners had sent in. And the first one is from Alan. He sent in two questions. The first one is, you have had lots of face-to-face time with witnesses, so have any of them had totally absurd stories?
Yes, and that's what would disqualify them as witnesses. So they're not. It's just that matter of fact. Witnesses very seldom step forward, especially regarding something of this nature. They most always have to be tracked down. And we've seen time and time again where they have unlisted phone numbers, where, I mean, there was even a case where we tracked down one of the former intelligence officers who was with the intelligence office of the 509 bomb group in Roswell at that time. And we came up with an address through air certification, assuming that, you know, a lot of the personnel at Roswell at that time would have continued on as pilots. And they would have, kept their pilot's licenses. They would renew them year after year, and as a result, they would be listed in this national directory. So we tracked a lot of them down originally through that very department. And this particular was Donald E. Carroll. And I remember how it was Marbleville, Texas, something like that. I remember my partner at that time, Kevin Randall, actually made the drive and went to the very address, and it was an empty lot.
Huh.
Now, granted, I mean, we didn't check it. I mean, Carroll may have owned the lot. He may have owned the property, but nonetheless, it was his listed address. It was his mailing address, nonetheless. And so, yeah, they've made it very difficult for us to find them. And then more times than not, too, when we do, their immediate reaction is, no, I have nothing to say, and they slam the phone down. We had one just a couple weeks ago again. Just slam the phone down on us. You know, don't ask me anything about that. You know, and slam the phone down. How did you find me? How did you get my name? Where did you get this number? So the first red flag is when anyone approaches us and kind of, you know, jumping up and down, raising their hand, you forgot about me. Well, we didn't forget about you. Believe me, if there's a witness out there or still out there, we will either find you or we've already talked to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes them legitimate witnesses, because we made the effort in the first place.
Right.
More importantly, the public comes to us, as I mentioned before, with little tidbits, little leads, little rumors. And then we're able to then look into investigate those little pieces of information. But as far as people actually stepping forward, no. Seldom is that the case. And more times than not, not legitimate. And we're already kind of rearing back as they approach us, knowing that this does not fit the standard.
And Alan's next question is, when do you think disclosure will happen? And I'm sure he's talking about Roswell.
Right. Well, certainly if Roswell is disclosed, then it solves the entire UFO mystery.
Exactly, yeah.
And as we so often have said, and I remind even my colleagues who, for some reason, in some quarters, they place themselves in competition with us as though if we succeed, it somehow puts them out, that it somehow you know, it's somehow cast them to the wayside. No, it doesn't. If we win, we all win.
Mm-hmm.
No different than for them. And no different than I encourage them to proceed in their endeavors, their efforts, to solve what I think I like to believe we unanimously would, you know, present as being the biggest story of the millennium, as we continue to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And nonetheless, colleagues who, you know, paint this picture that, well, disclosure is inevitable, that we just have to continue down the same course of action, and we're going to force their hands. Well, we haven't done it in 65 years.
Mm-hmm.
We've been working on Roswell now, in our case, for almost 25.
Wow.
And for the first number of years, yes, we thought that we were making headways. We were making progress in that direction. And we were hearing of this growing faction within the military that, yes, indeed, wants this all to come out. Well, even the growing faction is not being listened to. As I mentioned before, the old order not passing it down to the new.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they are now up to 4 official explanations regarding Roswell, it becomes quite apparent they're nailing that lid down tighter than ever, that they decided they're going to take it with them. And that does not warrant well for us with any hopes that it's going to be released anytime soon. The biggest obstacle they would face, not only that there would be culpability, the fact that we were, as we were discussing earlier, the threatening of American citizens, who is responsible? Who's, I mean, somebody, you know, whoever would accept and assume the responsibility for such actions would have hell to pay in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not talking about enemies of the state. We're talking about our very people. And we're threatened for no other reason than they happen to see something. And the other problem being, well, they've come up with 4 explanations. And how do they reverse each one of those?
Yeah.
Turn around and say, well, sorry, my mistake, and do it 4 times.
That's a good point.
So,
yeah.
So as a result, I personally don't see anything in the near future. I don't really see anything even in my future.
Mm.
I hope it's for your generation and the next generation, possibly. But the problem with that is, as I mentioned, if it's not being passed down, then it, when each and every one of us passes on, we take a part of it with us,
mm.
just as all those witnesses have. And it gets buried deeper and deeper and deeper to the point it's like a non-event. It's like it never happened. Then it does become folklore. And I think that's what they're also counting on. The idea that we believe it's the 5th explanation, actually, to Roswell. And I think who demonstrated that was when ABC did the 2-hour primetime special with the late Peter Jennings. Just before he passed away, on UFOs. And the segment on Roswell, in the opening paragraph, he used the word myth 5 times.
Mm. Wow.
And so I think that is their next explanation, and that's their hope, that this will eventually just become nothing more than a tall tale.
Wow.
That it'll become, you know, part of the legend, that Roswell now is assisting on. Roswell has become a big tourist attraction as a result,
mm-hmm.
and it will fall into the same, you know, fables of people who believe that Elvis is still alive and that
yep.
we never landed on the moon, and even the flat earthers who just, you know, they want to believe, and so it's the same with those Roswell, same with those kooky UFO people.
So I have one question here from Aaron. Kind of a lengthy question. I saw a video that showed a fragment that was found at the crash site, Roswell. Then it was scientifically tested, which was proven that it was manufactured and not made on Earth. Was that true? And if so, isn't that enough to prove to everyone that it happened?
The museum in Roswell, we used to have $1 million reward for any physical evidence provided And one of the requirements was that it would have to be independently tested by three separate laboratories, a third even being a tiebreaker if necessary. And the piece that this gentleman was talking about was recovered by our geologist, Professor Frank Kimbler, who works, he's part of our team, and will be one of our team leaders in our fourth archaeological dig that we're still making preparations for. And Professor Kimbler continues to work the site in our behalf and has recovered not just one piece, but a good sampling of pieces, all within a general area. But when I was with him, just a couple weeks ago, but when I was with him out at the site earlier this year, and we were marking off specifically where each fragment or each artifact has been found, they're separated by hundreds of feet. Now, what does that tell you? First of all, if it's from one source, one piece of metal, it would all be in one general area. I mean, you would find the fragments all in one area, no matter how it was broken up. But the fact that it's separated by hundreds of feet suggests that either it was a much larger object or that it was scattered over a much larger area. Well, I think both could possibly apply to this. A large object and scattered over a much larger area. Now, you talk about the tests. We've had tests done by two independent labs, and specifically on a radioisotope chart. There are specific elements that jump off the chart. They should not be there. And that's what's exciting, because both tests confirm the same thing. Those elements are not of any known manufacture here on Earth. Now, I'm very specific when I say known manufacture.
Right.
And as a result, it makes it rather exotic. It makes it rather mysterious in the sense that they cannot demonstrate to us where this process of arranging these elements can take place here on Earth. And unless anyone can demonstrate that, we have something extraordinary. Now, we're pushing for a third test. Now, if the third one corroborates the previous two, then we have the potential of, you know, having a press conference and at least demonstrating that something exotic, something beyond at least any known manufacturer here on Earth, was discovered at the very location the government claims a weather balloon had crashed back in 1947. Well, how do we account for this? And unless they can demonstrate something else coming down on that site, especially something of a material that is not of any known consistency here on planet Earth, and this is how we throw the onus back onto the government. This chess match will play out. Mm-hmm. And so we're making the next move at that point. We're going to ask them to demonstrate how such materials were either found at the site and how it turns out that they are of an extraordinary characteristic, mm-hmm. how it turns out that they are not balloon parts, but rather something of unknown nature, and that could be very exciting on our part.
Now, what's the stumbling block in getting that third test done?
The stumbling block, Martin, is the fact that all the national laboratories are all government contracted. And Professor Kimbler made the mistake, and I will accept responsibility. But we had one of the pieces sent to Sims Labs in Arizona. And the very director there had agreed to do it personally. So because it was so spontaneous, it was so impromptu, so the piece was sent out. It was FedExed to arrive the very next day. And it was all sealed in a special way, and it was all tracked as any FedEx parcel would be. And it arrived, and it sat in a lab room for a couple hours. When it was finally opened up, it was empty.
Ah.
And I had some heated exchange with Professor Kimmler. You know, luckily we have additional artifacts. Thank God it's not the only one we have.
Oh, my goodness.
And like the old press adage, well, then, you know, let's use it. Well, someone went out of their way to steal, essentially perpetrate a felony for either a piece of nothing or the real thing. Nonetheless, they made it a point that this was so important that it risked breaking the law. And so, again, we put out some bait, didn't intend to, but the next time if we should do such a thing, we're going to be there. They'll also snap the trap.
Wow. Tom asks, have you ever investigated any other crash sites?
I've been to Kingman, Arizona on two occasions. In fact, even put a number of blurbs in the local papers, hoping that if anybody had information regarding the alleged Kingman, Arizona crash from 1953, talked to a number of potential witnesses outside of Kingman as far as family. Nothing really came of it. I know that the book on the incident, the Aztec incident, is out presently by Scott and Susan Ramsey, and it's receiving a good amount of publicity and critical review within the UFO community. But if I accept Roswell, I have to accept the possibility that other crashes are possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so quick to mark my territory, so to speak. I have had colleagues that are quick to pounce on other such stories, and we can't have such double standards in that we make this into a race to the moon, so to speak.
Hmm.
That it's all Roswell or nothing, that type of thing. And I won't be so unfair. I will allow other investigators certainly to pursue other such cases, and hopefully we'll bolster as far as even the Roswell case, because if they justify and prove any other incident, it will strengthen Roswell.
Yes, our last question is from Ken, and he asks, "Do you ever have the crazy nuts that you see on the news try to convince you that they know something about the crash?"
Not so much about the crash, but about UFOs in general.
Mm.
I've ran into some people who were rather hostile towards the notion that, well, you guys are still trying to prove the nuts and bolts when, their vanguards. We're here. They're living amongst us. You know, we're part of this whole Star Children generation type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, I can humor such people and let them, have their 15 minutes, so to speak. But again, it's not the legitimate side of UFO research. It's not the side that so often the cable networks, the UFO hunters and the UFO chasers and all this, and late at night and all, wow, looking up at the light in the sky type of scenario. Well, a lot of it is digging into the ground. A lot of it is going through archival information. A lot of it is tracking down witnesses. A lot of it is just making that cold phone call where you don't know if someone's going to slam the phone down or cuss you out or scream at you to leave them alone, or how often we've been threatened they're going to call the police if we ever call again. That's the true nature of the UFO phenomenon. I mean, when we're investigators who investigate crimes minus a crime, so to speak, you're still going through the process of elimination. And as a result, anyone who, again, feels that they have the physical proof, we're all waiting. The world is waiting. Come forward. That's all it would take.
Mm-hmm.
And so save us the time. You accuse us of wasting our time. Well, again, make it easy for us.
Right.
I'd love to have the proof, but it's been elusive. And as a result, I know we've come close at times. And I know if anyone's going to crack this, I'd like to believe that we're going to be there when it happens. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, this isn't something subjective. It is going to take hard evidence. And as a result, we continue to look for the testimony regarding hard evidence. We continue to search the site for the hard evidence. And we continue to respond to the skeptics who, we were talking earlier, Martin, you know, of disclosure or even finalizing the investigation. And am I using the term mission accomplished? And that's going to be nothing short of finally solving this in my eyes will I walk away from this. But nonetheless, it will then be mission accomplished. If the skeptics, if the debunkers are so sure that theirs is the true nature of the UFO phenomenon, why do they continue to engage us? Why are they constantly shadowing us, looking over, you know, our shoulders? Why are they constantly responding to us? Because I can assure you and all your listeners that when I'm finished with this, I'm done. I get on with the rest of my life. It is mission accomplished. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that any skeptic that is confident that their mission is accomplished should leave us alone, should get on with their lives, should look for some other cause to pursue, because they're behaving as though the war continues.
Mm-hmm. They can talk about Elvis that I'll have on next week.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, where can someone find your website, Don?
Yes, the website is RoswellInvestigator.com, Roswell Investigator, one word.
Great.
And so there's also, we have our emails posted, and so we can always be reached. We take some of the better emails when we have a chance, but more importantly, we're working towards the next dig. We're working as far as completing the next book, and then we already are planning out the next book. And more importantly, we're still tracking down every final witness as we continue to race with the Undertaker. So,
that's right.
Sadly, the World War II generation is passing away right before our eyes.
Last time we spoke, I believe you said the ages left just 85 to 96 or something like that?
85 to 95, that is correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're still finding them, but the numbers are dwindling.
Right.
And each time I go down to Roswell, as being the Mecca for so many of the witnesses who were at one time there, it becomes a little bit more lonely each mm-hmm. time I pull into town.
Mm-hmm. Well, Don, you've been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for your patience and having me back.
Sure.
And we'll do it again, Martin, I'm sure.
I would like to. All right, so this is Martin Willis with Don Schmidt, and that's it for today.